deliver in-depth news coverage, provocative conversations, and, of course, arts programs. Remember to donate by visiting give2wbai.org or pledge right now from your smartphone. Text WBAI to 41444. Thanks in advance.
WBAI, 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 New York, New York, New York, New York, WBAI, 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 New York, New York, New York, New York.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
WBAI's got a lot of nerve. They challenge almost every social institution, but at least they leave religion alone.
Excuse me, but you're forgetting about equal time for free thought.
Whoa, horse! Equal time for free thought?
Yes, on Equal Time for Free Thought, they show how naturalistic worldview can help us become a more peaceful and just society.
That sounds interesting. When's this program on?
Every Saturday afternoon, from 2 to 3.
Are they the result of some kind of miracle?
No, just an excellent decision from BAI management.
That, little lady, is a miracle.
Whatever.
All right, I'm writing it down now. Equal time for a free thought. Saturdays from 2 to 3. That WBAI really does have a lot of nerve.
Meetings of Pacifica Foundation Radio's Board of Directors and all of its standing committees, including WBAI's Local Station Board and Community Advisory Board, are open to the public. WBAI Board and Committee meetings and Community Advisory Board meetings are posted in the events calendar of WBAI's homepage at least 1 week in advance of the scheduled date and announced on the air. In addition, all Pacifica Foundation radio meetings are posted at Pacifica.org under calendar, with links to audio streams carrying telephonic meetings and audio recordings of those meetings. If a meeting is closed to the public, a written explanation of the reason for closing will accompany the meeting's minutes available at Pacifica.org under calendar. If you want to be notified of meetings personally, please submit your email address to meetings at WBAI.org or call WBAI at 347-335-0633 during business hours.
My name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it, and I love that.
I have to celebrate you, baby.
Welcome to Health Action, a listener-supported community radio WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. In this week's program, we're going to be starting off by taking a look at healthcare issues that are being discussed and negotiated in this current city budget process that's going full tilt right now and will wrap up at the end of this month. And in the second part of the program, we'll be taking a look at the New Poor People's Campaign that's been launched nationally and here in New York and New York City as it addresses issues of social justice and this week focuses on health. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. Medicare's financial condition has taken a turn for the worse because of a predicted higher hospital spending and unexpected lower tax revenues that fund the program because of the new tax cut law, the federal government reported this week. In its annual report to Congress, the Medicare Board of Trustees said the program's Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, known as Part A, would begin running a deficit by 2026, 3 years earlier than projected last year. A senior government official who briefed reporters attributed the worsening outlook for Medicare to several factors that are reducing funding and increasing spending. He said the trustees projected lower wages for several years, which mean lower payroll taxes coming in to help fund the program. The recent tax cut passed by Congress would also result in fewer Social Security taxes being paid into the Hospital Trust Fund, Part A, as some higher-income seniors pay taxes on their Social Security benefits. The aging population is also putting pressure on Medicare's future finances. In addition, the spokesperson said recent moves by the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled Congress to kill two provisions of the Affordable Care Act are also now harming Medicare's future. Those were the repeal of penalties for people who don't have insurance and the repeal of an independent board charged with reining in Medicare spending if certain broad financial targets are not reached. The Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget said it was not surprising to see the three-year shift in Medicare solvency change since the trust fund operates on a narrow margin between revenue and expenses. Medicare's Part A Hospital Trust Fund is financed mostly through payroll taxes. It helps to pay for hospital care, home health services, nursing home, and hospice costs. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin played down any pending crisis, although he acknowledged Medicare faces many long-standing economic and demographic challenges. He said that the Trump administration's moves to cut taxes, ease federal regulations, and improve trade deals would help both Medicare and Social Security survive over the long term. Seema Verma, administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, said in a statement that the trustees' report should spur Congress to act on President Trump's proposed budget to cut Medicare spending during the next decade, mostly by reducing payments to doctors, nursing homes, and other providers. In a break from tradition, none of the Medicare trustees, which include the Secretaries of Treasury, Health and Human Services, and Labor, spoke to the press after releasing the report. A spokesman said they had scheduling conflicts. The Medicare trustees said the Part A Trust Fund will be able to pay full benefits until 2026, but then will gradually decline to be able to cover only 78% of projected expenses by 2039. Medicare provides health coverage to more than 58 million people, including seniors and people with long-term disabilities. Total Medicare expenditures were $710 billion last year in 2017. The congressional newspaper The Hill reports that the Senate Judiciary Committee announced this week that it's moving ahead on a controversial bill aimed at lowering drug prices. The bill, known as the CREATES Act, seeks to crack down on drug companies using tactics to delay introduction of cheaper generic drugs onto the market. It's been stalled for months amid intense opposition from pharmaceutical companies, despite it being sponsored by members of both parties. Senator Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee and a sponsor of the bill, is forging ahead, laying down a marker through action by its panel. He is scheduled for the committee to consider the bill by mid-June. A committee aide said that the panel's procedures, consideration of the bill would not likely happen until next week. The committee is expected to easily approve the measure, but the path forward after that in the full House is more murky. In the full Senate is more murky. Over in the House, lawmakers are working on a compromise version of the bill, with talks ongoing between House Energy and Commerce Committee and the Judiciary Committee. Attention on drug pricing has increased after President Trump's speech last month that called for lowering drug prices, but his plan mostly involves executive action, not legislative. And finally, the website Stat reports that the Food and Drug Administration has outlined a framework for cracking down on illegal opioid sales on the Internet. It also sent out a list of 9 online operators running a combined 53 websites, to which it had sent formal warnings for having engaged in illegal marketing and sales of highly controlled opioid painkillers. The extent of the FDA's direct enforcement authority is unclear, but the agency warned that companies that failed to correct violations outlined in the warning letters could have their products seized or face other legal action. Among the websites cited by the FDA were many that made clear their purpose: Anon Shop, Easy Buy Online, XL Pharmacy, and Tramadol Hub, the last one referring to the opioid Tramadol. Many of the websites included in the FDA's press release were no longer active as of the afternoon of the announcement. Others with particularly conspicuous names, such as OnlinePainPharma.com, appeared still operational. FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb last week announced an opioid summit to take place on June 27th, to which the FDA had invited numerous internet companies, including Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and Twitter. He said he hopes to work with those companies to step up their role played by U.S. tech giants in providing a platform for online companies whose marketing and sales activities are deemed suspicious. Gottlieb also cited a Senate report noting that users seeking to purchase online were often able to do so using prepaid credit cards, money orders, and even Bitcoin. And he made mention of the fact that the FDA employs investigators working to track such transactions on the so-called dark web. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment, taking a look at health issues at play in the current city budget process. Stay tuned. Welcome to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In the first part of the program this week, we're going to be taking a look at healthcare issues in the current city budget process that always happens this time of year. If it's June, it means that Congress starts to work on its budget bills. The state legislature is focusing on its overall session. And the city council and mayor are engaged in budget negotiations. Joining us to help sort all this out is Anthony Feliciano, executive director of the Commission on the Public Health System in New York City, and Wynn Parasamy. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Parasamy.
Okay, accent on the first syllable. Wynn Parasamy, policy analyst with the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agencies, now known as FPWA. Welcome, Anthony and Wynn, to the program. Anthony, let's get started a little bit. What's the kind of general budget process look like before we get into the particulars of what's being discussed around health?
Well, on all different levels of issues, particularly on health, it all depends on, in terms of the city council, individual council members' priorities, and then within their caucuses, and as well between their boroughs, how they're prioritizing the things that they're going to want to pay for. So this is a back and forth negotiation discussion. Some of it is normally things that they constantly repeat giving funding for. Some things, community-based organizations like myself, have to fight to restore. And then there are new initiatives that groups want to bring up that they want to make sure or see if there's any way of possibility for the council to support as part of their initiatives. Discretionary funding.
And generally, the whole process starts with the mayor putting his proposals on the table. From his end of things, how do things seem as a starting point?
Well, he releases his preliminary budget, and then that's reviewed by the council. There's some hearings. Then he finally releases his executive budget piece where the speaker, the negotiation with the council, review it as well. So far, it's like always in every year, there's a back and forth of what they want to fight for. Sometimes there's new initiatives. new ideas, and sometimes that may take precedence. So there is sometimes some tension on what they really want to pay for or continue to actually get funding for.
Wynn, if I can bring you into the conversation here, you're with an agency that works on a number of different issues. Before we zero in on the health stuff a little bit, what is the role of community-based organizations like yourselves and advocates? Well, how do they participate in the process?
So I think it depends on what kind of organization you're at and what your capacity is. So for us, for FCWA, we are a umbrella organization of member agencies who are human service providers. We're at close to 170 agencies across New York. And so really, in our situation, we're looking at what are the needs of human services providers that we work with, our member agencies, our coalition partners, and leveraging our policy for experience, our ability to, like, our real perspective and relationships. Sorry, I'm not a train.
It's okay.
Players to really kind of make sure that we can advocate for what these organizations need. So, for instance, health outreach, needs providers, single-payer health insurance. These are some of the things that I work on at FCWA.
And how do you normally do your advocacy vis-a-vis the city budget? What kinds of activities do community groups like yours undertake?
So really, from a city budget process, it is working with the organizations who we have a discretionary initiative that I work pretty closely on with Anthony, that we are one of the lead agencies on. So working with our organizations to understand what it is that they need in terms of budget, what current budget needs have, how their current budgets and discretionary funding has helped expand their ability to provide care to their organizations, and really taking that to less money, what their funding has meant for the city of New York, and how they can continue to grow and make a more equitable New York overall through enhancements or through maintenance or really just through a continuation of a funding increase.
Great. Anthony, now let's delve into the health issues a little bit. One of the perennial issues on the table and when it comes to health in the city budget process are for the two main city entities that focus on health, one being the Department of Health and the second is the Health and Public Hospital System. So let's take those kind of one at a time. What are the key things this year around the public health Department of Health and Mental Hygiene that advocates are focusing on?
So when we think about public health, we look at a broad spectrum. It's not just typical healthcare delivery services and programs. Many times are these issues, these initiatives that actually impact people's well-being. And particularly around mental health, for Commission on Public Health System, we've been working also with Citizens Committee for Children and other groups really around mental health services for children, ensuring that those are actually supported, particularly children under five, particularly for court-involved youth mental health initiatives. There is also around developmental, psychological, and behavioral health initiatives, and there's also just mental health for vulnerable populations. Given that there's been this big uptake on awareness around addressing mental health, we want to make sure a lot of those initiatives are restored and an additional enhancement to them, at least from a million to between 500,000 to a million in terms of enhancement, for particularly like mental health for children under five, we want to ensure it's restored at 1 million. At one point, many initiatives that Commission on Public Health System through the People's Budget Coalition with Federation and other groups, many things we were fighting for had to constantly be restored, but many initiatives have become baseline. So it's part of the mayor's executive budget, but then things like mental health services for children and so on have not been baseline. So we are constantly making sure that those get restored. Then there is the big initiative when women speak about platforms and CBO's involvement. There's also this thing about Access Health NYC, the initiative around ensuring people have access to coverage, understand coverage, but also know their rights. And given this environment, federal environment we're all in, there's a critical initiative that for 2.5 years already we have with New York Immigration Coalition, Coalition for Managing Children and Families, Community Service Society, and Federation with WIN have been addressing and making sure we get funding for that back and an enhancement up to $2.5 million.
Yeah, we'll talk more with WIN and the particulars about that in a moment. Let's turn now to the city's public hospital system, which always seems to be in a dire financial situation. How are things kind of going with that? There's a new head of the system that's come in recently, and what's the mayor proposing to do to help stabilize that system? Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I lost you there for a moment, okay. But I did hear. So with the coming in of Dr. Katz, who is the new CEO and president of Health and Hospitals, there is a renewed initiative to one to ensure that this largest safety net in our city in the country has the finances that it needed to continue sustaining itself and providing services. So what I mean by that, because of federal cuts, because of certain state cuts around Medicaid, also around what we call disappointing share dollars, which is around providing care for uninsured and underinsured. We have to make sure on the city level that the subsidies that are given to the public hospitals are increased, but also maintained and moved forward. While Dr. Katz and working with hopefully with community-based organizations and labor try to develop solutions because of the financial vulnerability of the public hospitals. Mm.
And what's the financial situation with the public hospital system now? Is the debt coming under control? Do we need more? What's the mayor proposed?
Well, one, with the delay on the disappointing share cuts, even though it's delayed for 1 year, you're still going to, that's just an accumulated effect, but it will be part of the 2019-2020 also
and that
a
was
big issue.
Done in so, Congress, so we've staved that yeah. off for 1 year. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. However, the city, in terms of debt, there's still not only just debt, there's still just major changes that still have to be made. I think Dr. Katz has worked hard, one, to look at where expense has been, because the issue of health and health has not really been an expense issue as much as a revenue issue. So the question is how to bring in more revenue, obviously by ensuring that more uninsured people have access to the public system, come in. And the second is to look at what has been expended on. So many times Health and Hospitals spend a lot of money on consultants to do a lot of the work that could have been done internally or with other groups. And so he's made major cuts to the consulting budget for Health and Hospitals. He's rearranging in terms of making sure there's something called telemedicine, which meaning ways to reduce waiting times and the availability of doctors and find ways to lower those costs. I think he's taking the right steps. The question for us is where are the community-based owners going to be more involved in this, how we're going to keep addressing this issue, because there's still much to be done at the health and hospitals level.
And before we leave the Department of Health itself, our Commissioner of Health, Dr. Mary Bassett, has developed a whole initiative around health equity to promote that, address those issues at a city level. How is that coming along? What's that looking like?
Well, one is by bringing community-based organizations that are trusted brokers in the neighborhood, collaborating, coming together to inside these the old health and hospital buildings that are now be coined the action centers. Second is to develop a clear framework of health equity, so every department in the city Department of Health, every division is going to train you this understanding what they need to do together in a comprehensive way to address disparities and health inequities in neighborhoods. I also, you know, I don't know if Wynn wants to jump on this because, you know, Federation has also been involved in all those areas as well, as in an important way of framing the issue of disparities, but also where we have to put the funding particularly on the very local level work. Initiatives that are proven, that have, maybe they're not always evidence-based, but there are practices that are really keeping communities well.
I'm in on that. Are you there, Wynn?
Yeah, I'm here. Okay. Wait, sorry, I didn't catch your question.
Just a little bit about the issue of health equity here in our city, and then that'll be a nice segue for us to talk about the Access Health NYC program that your agency is helping to lead.
Yeah, I mean, I think Anthony put it pretty nicely. There can be some misunderstanding and about the importance of looking at truly local level solutions, because people just don't really know about both what it takes to keep a community, especially a low income community, able to access not just health insurance, but also once they have their health insurance, how to use it, how to get the health services they need, how to actually pay for it, because sometimes health insurance doesn't cover everything, as we are all very familiar with in different degrees in our lives. And so I think that is a question of health equity, and that is a question of how do we communicate about initiatives and organizations that are doing truly remarkable work, even if it's not necessarily it's not necessarily in sort of quantifiable hard stats, but more in a qualitative perspective of just having a communication, having a conversation with someone about their health and their health status and their health access.
So tell us maybe a little bit about what this Access Health NYC program is, how people can find out about it, take advantage of it.
So Access Health NYC it's in its third year of being funded at a discretionary level. So it's funded yearly. It's currently funded at $1 million. And what that $1 million is used for the year is to train, provide resources, technical assistance, et cetera, to 13 different community-based organizations working across the city. Some names of organizations that get this funding is Make the Road, Boom Health, organizations that are Voces Latinas, organizations that really have the trust of their communities and the respect of their communities in terms of, you're looking at these community-based organizations serve immigrant communities, low-income communities, people living with or at risk for HIV, formerly incarcerated, underinsured or uninsured. So you're really looking at populations who, not just in today's political climate, but just in general overall, health insurance and health access can be a question of safety, of whether or not you feel like you qualify for health insurance or if you can afford it. And by providing funding to these organizations, through Access Health NYC, what the city is actually allowing these organizations to do is provide health outreach, to have conversations, to go to barbershops, go to embassies, to go to bars, and where communities are, to really go to them and to start having a conversation, having a dialogue with individuals about how their health is and how what tools they need and what help they need to actually improve their health. And this is an initiative, it's a pretty unique initiative. There's not really anything quite like it in terms of city funding and city services. And also community-based organizations are operating at the margins. They're operating with bare bones budgets. So even if they have the ability to sign someone up for health insurance, they don't necessarily have the ability to do the outreach to let their communities know that this is a service that is available to them, that they could qualify for, that they could receive linguistically appropriate, culturally responsive help with. And so the organizations that have had this funding, as part of my work, I spent a lot of time getting to know what these organizations do with this funding. And it's really been able to create opportunities to connect with their communities, not just about health insurance, but about with HIV, getting people on preventative services, getting people to know their status and get tested for HIV. So it really, and this isn't something that a lot of the staff that organizations, they didn't, like for On Access Health Funding, they didn't, their job didn't exist at these organizations before Access Health. So what we're looking for and what we're trying to communicate to the city, to council members, to organizations, to communities, is that this is an option, and that this is a resource that you can use, and that the city can really use to make health access and health equity that much closer to a real reality in New York.
Right, and as always, any program like this needs more money, which is why we're talking about it in the context of the budget process. Anthony, just to finish up with you in our last minute or so, where are we at in the budget process now, and what's expected in the coming weeks? How's it going to all play out?
Well, this is budget negotiation, so each of the boroughs come back and forth in terms of their priorities, their initiatives, negotiating within the borough, with working with the speaker's office to negotiate with the mayor's office. So we're looking at, you know, not maybe another 2 or 3 weeks of running this through. And so it all depends on the advocacy externally from groups like Federation, CPHS, and others. It goes with continuing, making sure we have champions, council members who are champions in the city council, but also that we're informing them of why these type of services, particularly like Access Health NYC, is not only unique, it's not duplicative, it is even more important than ever, given what we see going on the federal level in terms of the attacks to our health or our access to healthcare. And I just want to add, just on the Access Health thing, there's a great importance of having CBOs all talk with each other, be trained together, learn together, and provide accurate information out to communities. Because that has, you know, given this time of information that's not so accurate, we want to make sure that communities have the right information and know how to navigate the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking in this segment about healthcare issues that are at play in the current city budget process, which will wrap up by the end of this month. Our guests have been Anthony Feliciano, who's executive director of the Commission on the Public Health System in New York City, and Wynn Parasamy. I'm sorry, Parasamy, policy analyst.
Don't worry about it.
With the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agency, now known as FPWA, who's joining us by train, so giving us a little bit of audio verite there. Thank you so much, Wynn. And we'll be back with our second segment in this week's program, taking a look at the new Poor People's Campaign as it addresses issues of social justice and health. Stay tuned.
We've got our friends at CNN here. You guys love breaking news, and you did it. You broke it. I think what no one in this room wants to admit is that Trump has helped all of you. He couldn't sell steaks or vodka or water or college or ties or Eric, but he has helped you. He's helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you're profiting off of him.
We're with you, Michelle Wolf, but if corporate media has got you down, maybe you should try WBAI. We're listener-supported community radio, questioning the mainstream narratives trumpeted by the news profiteers. But in order for this whole thing to work, we need your help. Please go to give2wbai.org to find out how you can support WBAI or call 516-620-3602. And thanks for supporting Free Speech Radio on WBAI New York.
And welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In the second half of this program, we're going to be talking to two people about the new Poor People's Campaign that has emerged on the scene in 40 states across the country. We're going to be talking about what's been happening here in New York. Joining us is Reverend Emily McNeil, who's the executive director of the New York Labor Religion Coalition and coordinates the campaign here in New York State, and her colleague, Reverend Claudia de la Cruz, who helps coordinate the New York City Poor People's Campaign operation. Welcome to Health Action, Emily and Claudia.
Thank you.
So, Emily, let me start with you. We'll get a little bit of the big picture here. Give us a little bit of background on how, for people who may not be familiar, the Poor People's Campaign really builds on a similarly named initiative some 50 years ago, started by Dr. Martin Luther King. Tell us about what happened then and why it's being relaunched now.
Yeah, exactly. So 50 years ago, at the time of Dr. King's assassination, he and many others were working to organize a Poor People's Campaign. And they were doing so because they recognized the limits of the really significant victories they had won in the Civil Rights Movement, but yet knew that African Americans had been integrated into a society that was fundamentally sick, that it was impacted by systemic racism and militarism and materialism, and that much more fundamental changes needed to happen in order to achieve the kind of values that folks like Dr. King espoused. And so he believed, and others, that they needed to unite folks on the bottom, the poor and dispossessed, as he said, and build a movement that would unite people across lines of race, across different regions of the country, and that would bring a moral witness to Washington, D.C. to show the nation and to show people in the Capitol the suffering that was happening all across the country, and to really put forth a demand that that poverty be ended in the U.S. And around the world, and to really make the case that there is no reason in a land of abundance and a wealthy country, both then and that continues now, for people to go without. And so on this 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death, as well as the 50th anniversary of that campaign, which did go ahead after he was killed, we are coming to grips with the fact that we are not only still facing many of the problems that he talked about, but actually many of them have gotten worse. And the solution that he and others put forward, we believe, is still the solution, that we have to build a social movement that unites people across the lines that divide us, that is led by the most directly impacted, and that puts forward a different moral vision for this country that says, very, you know, at a very basic level, that we have enough for people to have a decent life, and for their dignity to be respected. And so because of that, we have to demand it.
And Claudia, the Poor People's Campaign is midst a 40-day period of action, and we'll get to discussing that in a minute. But what sort of led up to launching this 40-day period of action?
I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of folks have asked, you know, why a Poor People's Campaign? I think that there's always been a distorted narrative around poverty, and we speak about poverty as if the poor were the ones responsible for their poverty. And I think, you know, when folks ask the question, why a Poor People's Campaign? Well, because there are still poor people. And for as long as there are still poor people, we have to struggle to deconstruct the conditions of poverty, and not attack the poor for a condition that they are not responsible for creating. And I think the current economic and social political crisis in which we are living, and even, you know, spiritual human crisis that we're living, we have no other choice but to create a campaign that brings together the different movements and struggles and says, you know, enough is enough. And we need to start envisioning what a world without these systems of oppression look like, and what type of structures and what type of projects that are beyond the survival mode do we need for our communities to thrive. And so I think that the context is ripe for us to be able to be in the development of this multi-year campaign that we're calling the Poor People's Campaign and National Call for Moral Revival.
And let me tease that out a little bit. I've been to some of the meetings and trainings and so forth for the campaign. This call for moral revival seems to be at the core of this newly revived Poor People's Campaign. Can you talk a little bit more about what that's all about?
Yes. From the campaign, we understand that there has been the control of a moral narrative, and a moral narrative that is distorted, that, again, shames the poor for their poverty, that values or likes to speak more to who people choose to love rather than how people live and why people live in the conditions they live, that chooses war and attacks on communities in different ways, whether there be through policies or militarization, rather than choosing to put money and prioritize human life with providing what is needed in institutions such as the healthcare system or the education system. And when we talk about this moral distortive narrative is what is utilized to justify the conditions that have been created. And what we're saying is that what is really immoral is the criminal act of not having access to health care because you're poor, the criminal act of not having access to housing because you're poor, not having access to be able to breathe clean air because you're poor. Those are criminal acts, and those are things that are being, again, plotted and decided by politicians that really don't care about our quality of life. And so there is a morality that has been claimed to be apolitical, when in reality, its actions are extremely political. And so what we're saying is that we need to be able to build a movement that calls out that type of morality that is distorted, that is wrong, and reclaim the type of morality that is about human life and the preservation of life and the preservation of our existence, and the continuous preservation of our Mother Earth as well. Hopefully that answers some of the questions.
Yes, thank you very much. Emily, turning back to you, we are in this 40-day period of action, about the middle, maybe a little over halfway through. Can you basically describe the format and structure of this period that the Poor People's Campaign is in and its national scope?
Sure, yeah. So this period that we're in of 40 days is about 6 weeks, and we're now in week four. First of all, it's coordinated across the country. So there have been actions happening on a weekly basis in 30 to 36 state capitals and Washington, D.C. And each week we're lifting up different themes that relate to the overall theme of the campaign, which is taking on systemic racism, poverty, militarism, and ecological devastation. So the first week we focused on women and children and people with disabilities and the LGBT community and poverty. The second week we talked about systemic racism and its link to poverty, lifting up issues around mass incarceration and immigrant rights and voting rights, the treatment of indigenous communities and Islamophobia. The third week we talked about militarism, the war economy, and gun violence. And then this week, the focus was on the right to health care and to a healthy environment. And so each week we have mobilizations at state capitals all over the country. And this includes lifting up the stories and as well as the numbers about how, in our case, New York is impacted by these issues. And also engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience. And that's part of the campaign as kind of an expression of the crisis that we're in, as well as a demonstration of the power that regular people have when they come together. So the first week we shut down the streets around the state capitol for about 3 hours. The second week we blocked all the entrances and exits of the state capitol and shut down business there for a while. The third week we occupied the war room of the state capitol, which is a room covered in these pretty grotesque murals of the wars that New Yorkers have fought in, including the colonial conquest of indigenous peoples here. And we occupied that room, and folks were removed when they refused to leave at the time of the building closing. And then last week, we also occupied space within the Capitol and blocked the Senate chambers and the governor's office. So it's both about, these actions are about bringing folks together from across the state, telling the stories of what we're facing, and also disrupting business as usual. So that's kind of the focal point of these weeks of action. But we also do other things, including political education events on Tuesdays, cultural events on Thursdays, and mass meetings on Sundays. And every week there's programming in D.C. that then folks can tune into either on their own, or we have gatherings too for folks to get together and share those events.
And looking forward to the next 2 weeks when folks will be coming to the Albany again. And I was there this past Monday for the action you just described, where we blocked entrances to lawmakers' chambers. What's coming up the next 2 weeks? What are the themes?
So this coming week, the theme is Everybody's Got a Right to Live, which actually comes from a song that was written during the first Poor People's Campaign. And we're going to be highlighting living wages, labor rights, the right to organize, as well as housing and education. And then the sixth week is a new and unsettling force, which comes from another song that we've been using in the campaign. And we're going to be highlighting again kind of the link between all of these issues that we've highlighted so far, and really the need for a mass movement and for a moral revolution, kind of as Claudia was talking about.
Claudia, turning back to you, Emily spoke a lot about song, and every single Poor People's Campaign event that I've been to in the last month or two starts with song, ends with song, uses song throughout it. Tell us about the importance, and why use that technique in the events?
I think more than anything, we understand as a campaign, and kind of learning from the traditions of in movement building, that culture is at the heart of the conception of anything that is progressive and is liberating. And so culture for us is at the center of all the work that we are doing, as is political education. And so culture is one of the ways in which we also educate. And it's very rare that we may remember, I don't know, a quote very directly from a book, but it's very, very often that we remember the words of a song. And so we understand that song moves our hearts and moves our minds, and also shapes the possibility of what could come next, our vision and our imagination. And so we utilize a lot of the songs, not only from, you know, the 60s, but from folks that are part of the community and part of the movement today, and are writing and are being inspired by struggle. And so we uplift the culture that comes from the people in our movement. And so I think that's very much the heart of the campaign.
Yeah, last evening I was at one of your events that focused on health issues, and we ended the meeting with a song coming out of the Movement for Black Lives. So it is contemporary. It's very interesting. Emily, how are state officials and our lawmakers responding to this weekly kind of a whole bunch of people show up and they do something to sort of try to stop business as usual? What's been their reactions and thoughts?
Yeah, so they haven't always been very pleased with us being disruptive. Actually, unfortunately, the Albany mayor was particularly upset with our actions the first couple weeks. I think, protest happens a lot in this town and at the Capitol, but I think that we're doing something different. One, in that it's sustained, that these aren't one-off protests, but we're coming back week after week. and we're trying to do creative action and different things. So, you know, I think it's shaken people up a little bit in a good way. They are getting used to us showing up. There's been a heavy presence of state troopers. And I think it's a recognition, a sign of kind of the power that this movement is bringing that makes folks uncomfortable. And that's, you know, the part of the tradition of civil disobedience is that kind of tension, that confrontation is one of the ingredients of moving forward. And we're very committed to nonviolence and at the same time recognize that it's confrontation and tension that we have to use to move things forward.
Claudia, you've been working with a crew of people here in New York City to coordinate the mass meetings, the teach-ins, and the cultural events. Let's sort of take them a little bit one by one so people can get a little familiar with them and perhaps attend one or more of them. What happens on a Sunday mass meeting?
Well, during the Sunday mass meetings, and I want to reemphasize the fact that this is happening throughout other states as well. So we're doing this in a coordinated manner. So in the different states, folks are also holding mass meetings. And the Sunday mass meetings are spaces of deep reflection and exchange. Folks speak to the different themes the themes of the week and exchange on their experiences based on those. And again, we do it in a way in which people share an analysis that's intersectional and are coming from spaces of expertise based on the experiences of organizing and leading struggles and being impacted by the conditions that are created by the different systems. And there's a live stream that happens where we are able to watch the services, the mass meetings that are taking place in the different states as well with Reverend Liz and Dr. Reverend Barber, where they themselves also bring forth like a moral grounding, and there are the speakers as well that are speaking to the theme and the issues in their communities. And so we find some sort of connectedness during the Sunday mass meetings where it's not the community where it happens alone, but we're in connection to the other states as well, and we're in conversation around what other folks are talking about in North Carolina, in D.C., and other states. On Mondays, as we've mentioned, we do the mobilizations to Albany. So from the different regions of the New York State, in coordination with other states that are also doing this, we move to the Capitol, and we have nonviolent moral direct actions at the same time, which I think has also been something that breaks the isolation that we often feel, and being able to know that we are doing this in the state, but that this is being done across the United States has also been very powerful. On Tuesdays, we have the Teaching Tuesdays, where folks that are coming from different struggles come together and educate, inform the community, and also inspire the community to be able to move forward and struggle and making the connections that we often don't make. So how does healthcare connect to the prison industrial complex? How does it connect to the housing? Understanding that we're working under a human rights framework where we're not talking about these different issues in isolation, but in connection to each other. And so we need to talk about struggle in connection to each other. And so we have folks coming from those different struggles that are and that are organizing or that they're educating around and share with the larger community. There are live streams as well. There are political education sessions that are happening also in D.C. simultaneously as people meet. And there are reflections around those exchanges. And then on Thursdays, we have the cultural event where, again, we lift up the culture of the people. There have been folks that, you know, engage in different mediums of art, whether it is spoken word, whether it is singing, drumming. We've had vendors. We've had a variety of folks that are just working through the arts and contributing to struggle by giving us an imagination of what the future could look like. So those are the events that we've been coordinating.
And let me offer you the opportunity to plug the cultural event that's happening on Thursday evening, June 7th, that New Yorkers could participate in.
Thank you. Yes. So tomorrow we're going to be hosting an event in the South Bronx in a community garden that is historic for opening up its doors to different social movements and uplifting struggles that are not only from the Bronx, but from throughout the boroughs and throughout the states and also internationally. And the garden's called the Little Green Garden, the Rock, and it's located on 160th Street and Elton Avenue. We're going to have Garifuna drummers, spoken word artists, folks that are going to be doing hip-hop. We're going to have a barbecue. It's going to be a community, kids-friendly event. Again, uplifting the right that we have to health and a healthy planet in connection to the struggles for affordable housing and others. So tomorrow, 160th Street and Elton in the South Bronx, free food, free music, community building.
And what time do things start there?
It starts at 6 and it goes through 8:30.
Great. And Emily, in our last minute, if I can maybe ask you to look forward a little bit to events here in New York State for the New York Poor People's Campaign. We've talked about the 40 days of direct action that we'll be completing. Then everything sort of culminates in Washington, D.C. from all around the country. Can you give us a quick summary of what's in store there?
That's right. It's really exciting things planned. So our final direct action here in Albany will be June 18th, Monday, as always. And then some folks from New York will be heading down to D.C. really the following day, the 19th. And there will be delegations from all the states that are participating that will gather. There will be kind of a mini Resurrection City, which is the encampment from the original Poor People's Campaign that will be set up on the National Mall. And there will be workshops and events and actions throughout the week leading to a really big rally on June 23rd, which is a Saturday. And we will have buses leaving from all over the state. So some folks will be there throughout the week, and then a whole bunch of us will be in D.C. on the 23rd to both wrap up this 40 days of action, but more importantly, to look ahead to what comes after, which is going to be a lot of continuing to do movement building and political education and relationship building and voter registration, and really continuing to imagine what we can do to continue to build power and then use that power to make change.
And if people go to the Poor People's Campaign website, poorpeoplescampaign.org, and follow the clicks you can click through to New York and how to contact and plug into all this sort of stuff. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking about the new Poor People's Campaign as it addresses issues of social justice. And this week, the focus has been on health issues. Our guests have been Reverend Emily McNeil, who's executive director of the New York Labor Religion Coalition and coordinates the campaign here in New York State, and her colleague, Reverend Claudia de la Cruz, who's a coordinator of the New York City Poor People's Campaign. Thanks so much, Emily and Claudia, for joining us on Health Action.
Thank you, Mark, for the invitation.
You're welcome. And that'll do it for this week's program. We'll catch you back here next week. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for the recording and editing the program. I'm Mark Hanna. We'll be right back.
On Sunday, June 10th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents trumpeter and composer Adam O'Farrill. Join us as we discuss Adam's musical lineage, working with a sibling, and what motivates his musical exploration. That's Sunday, June 10th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
I'm Cynthia Nixon. I'm running for governor of New York State, and I love WBAI. My dad and I used to listen together every weekend, and I'm a lifelong WBAI listener.
Is this where you wait for the bus to Luxembourg?
Yes, I'm taking the bus to Luxembourg.
Well, I'm not going to stay in Luxembourg.
Me either. I'm taking the train to Paris.
Well, me too. Are you going to stay in Paris?
No, I'm flying on to New York.
Well, I'm flying on to New York.
Brooklyn, really?
I'm going to Brooklyn.
What for?
To see John McDonough's Off the Meter at the Brooklyn Common.
Tales of a New York City cab driver.
Saturday night, June 23rd.
Me too.
Oh, really?
The great Malachi McCord is a special guest star.
I know. I can't wait.
Show starts at 7. Tickets are available at WBAI.org.
I got my tickets.
Me too. Off the Meter is a benefit performance for WBAI.
I know. I don't want to miss it.
You won't, but first...
But first what?
Don't miss the bus.
If you miss the bus to John McDonough's Off the Meter, take a taxi.
Hello, listeners. I'm WBI's General Manager, Berto Reimers. I'm happy to announce that we have successfully moved out of the Empire State Building and are now transmitting from 4 Times Square. This is a major accomplishment and a turning point in our history, with a savings to WBI of $50,000 per month. With your help, we have preserved this precious media, but the task has just begun. We are now engaged in a campaign to liquidate the loan that allowed us to move forward. I encourage you to become a BAI buddy, a sustaining member to help WBI bring in a steady, predictable income. We want to reduce and eventually eliminate on-air fund drives. Please go to WBAI.org and become a member, and stay tuned for exciting new programming launching on WBAI in the very near future. Thank you.
The Community Advisory Board will be meeting on Sunday, June 10th at 1 p.m. at the 60 Wall Street Atrium. All listeners are welcome to attend. Once again, the Community Advisory Board will be meeting on Sunday, June 10th at 1 p.m. at the 60 Wall Street Atrium. All listeners are welcome to attend.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, two pieces that are both delightful and not so delightful. One is a reading by Thomas M. Dish, and the other by Gardner Dozois. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I just spent a few minutes searching for interviews with Ari Aster, the writer-director who's making his feature film debut with Hereditary. This is something I don't usually do for a review. I'm of the opinion that whatever you feel about a film should be influenced by the film only. But I came out of this with conflicting feelings, most of them centered around doubts about whether Mr. Aster is... And I mean this in the least snarky way possible, for real. I'll explain what I mean by that in a sec. There's no doubt that Hereditary is an impressive, gripping work. It's also a pretty unsparing work, starting off dark with a family, and Annie, an artist who specializes in exquisitely detailed miniatures, played by Toni Collette, Steve, the patriarch, that's pretty much his defining feature, played by Gabriel Byrne, Peter, a sullen teen, played by Alex Wolff, and Charlie, a young girl with some very odd, hell-disturbing habits, played by Millie Shapiro, attending the funeral of Annie's especially problematic mother. The film then spirals down the rabbit hole with an especially disturbing event. I can't say what, its impact depends on it coming unexpectedly, that tests the bonds of the family and raises questions about some secrets held by Annie's mother and what that woman wanted from her daughter and her grandkids. And let me just say that if you've ever held the desire to see Toni Collette pass through multiple rings of hell, Hereditary is your movie. Once that gut-wrenching event occurs about a half hour in, she's pretty much a non-stop kaleidoscope of anguish, from inconsolable grief to vitriolic anger to wild-eyed mania. The movie puts the actress through so many ringers that there's a point where it begins to feel a little sadistic. Lars von Trier could watch this film and go, "Geez, dude, back off." But it has to be said that as unsparing as Hereditary is, it is a compelling exercise. Aster knows how to insert the needle and when to twist. What kept pulling me back is the film's supernatural turn, which is predicated on an interesting concept. Again, I can't elaborate, but is invoked with such hoary elements as automatic writing and stock seance ceremonies. And despite the visual evidence that supernatural forces are at work, just the fact that the strange events occur within the cliché of people assembled around a table, touching hands, adds a distance that interferes with me buying into things. I actually became more sympathetic with Annie's family, who, when Annie hysterically tries to coax them into helping her conjure the dead, regard her as the unhinged person she really does appear to be. And this is where I began my frantic search for some confirmation of where Astor is coming from. Because the hoarier elements of heredity could just be laziness, or it could be that their very presence is meant to be regarded as some kind of commentary. There's evidence that Astor isn't completely presenting his scenario as some kind of objective reality. The film is full of surreal little elements. There's a bizarre moment when Annie, maker of miniatures, labors over a miniature gallery filled with miniature versions of her miniature works. And there's the way Charlie has a penchant for building miniature effigies out of discarded garbage, and the occasional bird head, a practice which is requoted later in the film on a plus-sized scale. So in doing my searches, I came upon this quote from Astor, talking about how he envisions his career. "I'm hoping that these films are nuanced enough, that they serve as serious cinema in a way that doesn't present me as a horror filmmaker." Okay, fair enough, nobody wants to be pigeonholed. But note the distancing of horror from quote-unquote serious cinema. This may be an important distinction within the industry. This quote is from an interview on IndieWire, so Astor may well have been speaking the language. I still bristle at the suggestion, maybe unintentional, that a horror film cannot be serious cinema as well. But it does make it interesting that a film whose supernatural elements have some provocative ideas behind them chooses to express those ideas with off-the-shelf ghost story trappings. And I kind of feel that my distance isn't completely wrong. Maybe the director was holding his own work at arm's length as well, which makes my feelings about Hereditary especially mixed. It is a supremely grueling exercise. This ain't Stephen King's It or even Get Out. It is well-mounted, beautifully envisioned, and intensely felt. It stumbles with Astor's odd attitude towards its supernatural elements. But it is quite a singular experience, and I'll take that any day. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Thank you, Dan. It's a provocative review. I find it curious. We know that whether he's going to the Astor, whether he's going to allow himself to be pigeonholed or not, it's not a movie that I'm going to be seeing, because whether he is a horror film director or not, stuff that turns your stomach, that is intended to turn your stomach and leave eye worms, you know what an earworm is, right? It's when you have a tune in your head and you just cannot get that tune out of your head for whatever reason. There was a fun article about earworms not long ago in Quartz, which is one of my preferred online news services, and they had a very good piece about earworms. So what would that be, eye worms, when, you know, you just cannot unsee something as a result of what it is. So hopefully somebody will come up with something and let me know what they think. But eye worm is what I'm going to use for a little while. I'm not doing a Facebook Live this morning. I don't have a guest, and it's fun to watch a guest, or if I were doing mostly a reading aloud, and I'm going to do a short one, under 5 minutes long, then that might be a good reason to do a Facebook Live so that you can watch and enjoy what is going on. But it does distract me. It is an issue. Last week, in fact, there's more than one issue at hand. One issue is that if the WBAI router is not working, we're talking about the Wi-Fi router, and I have yet to see it work really well for a full 2 hour period. What happens is, A, it interrupts the actual stream. so that people watching don't get to see it. This happened near the end of the show last week. Number two, if it throws me off the Wi-Fi and starts using mobile data, well, mobile data is limited. And 2 hours of video broadcasting, forget watching, just watching something from Netflix or something like that, but broadcasting something takes up about 2 gigabytes, about a gigabyte an hour, okay? P.S. properly, the word is gigabyte, but I had to give up that battle a long, long time ago. So, so I will decide from week to week when I will be doing a video add-on to the program.